We've never had a land or water conservation target that big before, certainly not one that becomes an agreement that 196 countries around the world are all aiming for.
A big deal for biodiversity. It's Monday, December 19th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, we'll dig into the international deal to protect nature that world leaders just struck in Canada. It aims to reverse the catastrophic collapse of biodiversity that scientists have warned about for decades. And we've got some year-end lessons from 2022's economic turmoil. But first, about that World Cup. Even the most casual soccer fans, and I should know, were riveted by the championship match between France and Argentina Sunday, which went down to a penalty kick shootout. Lionel Messi finally got his FIFA World Cup and brought Argentina their first title in 36 years. Argentine fans around the world are going to be celebrating for at least the next 4 years. That includes the Philadelphia Inquirer's soccer editor, Andrea Canales. She spoke to Scott Tong this morning.
It was cathartic, I think, for anyone who has a connection to the country, how much they love the sport. It's just amazing to see the Hollywood ending that was too crazy for even Hollywood.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So let's talk about the game. And the Argentines went up 2-0, 2-0 in the first half. I mean, they bossed the French at the outset. How did they do it?
It was basically a culmination of all the potential we've seen from Argentina through the years. They did get that early penalty, and it allowed the team to relax because sometimes we've seen them tense up and make mistakes on the biggest stage and not play up to their potential. This time they were playing. That second goal was just such a beautiful connection of team plays. The passes. France is very good. They were the defending champions. I picked them to win last World Cup. And they were deserving defending champions. You know, defending champions usually have a letdown. They did not. If anything, in some games, in some ways, they looked better than they were when they won it in 2018.
And then, of course, yesterday in the second half, France comes roaring back on the back of you-know-who.
Mbappe, yes. Mbappe, in a three-minute span, they got a penalty of their own. And then they scored from the run of play. Again, a beautiful goal. And it's just coming so fast, right, when Argentina was in the letdown of giving up the penalty. I actually have to commend the ref because I think the calls were all valid, even if I did have a slight rooting interest.
Well, right, the ref called three penalty kicks, right, during the game and during overtime.
Yes, and one was the handball, which can seem like an injustice because it caught the defender on the elbow. But then there was the redemption arc of that defender being the same one who actually hit the deciding penalty kick in the shootout.
Yeah. I mean, Hollywood could not have written this better from Argentina's perspective. But Mbappe got what's called the golden boot. He scored the most goals in this tournament. But the player of the tournament award went to one Lionel Messi. By the way, they're teammates on the Paris professional club team. How special was Messi yesterday?
Incredibly. I think the whole thing about Mbappe, you know, winning the golden boot and scoring three goals, he scored every goal for France, and yet coming up just a little bit short is incredible. But also, Messi played well enough in the 2014 tournament to win the golden ball as the best player, and yet lost out, obviously, on the World Cup. So that moment when he kissed the trophy and wasn't just holding something that said, you're the best player, but no, you don't win the title. It's kind of interesting because they have to go back to the same club team and, I guess, commiserate along with Neymar. If you think about it, that just makes it all the more incredible that these three top players are all on one club team.
Yeah, this Paris PSG team, owned by Qatar, we should note. I want you to take a long view of this tournament. It began, of course, with a lot of controversy over human rights. When you kind of step back and think about the whole picture, what comes to mind?
I like to think in some ways a bit of a triumph of the human spirit in terms of, I think the attention that was called to it was justified and important because this stuff is happening around the world and too often it's easy for people to close their eyes to it. And yet even opening their eyes and actually allowing some things to change because there were, and it can seem like I just don't want to make the perfect the enemy the good in terms of the progress that was made, in terms of certain workers' rights causes were advanced and there was some oversight, obviously not as much as there needed to be, but we can still have that ideal as the ultimate goal. I think anything that gets us thinking more about what's going on with everyone else around the world and gets us out of our bubbles. I mean, it's called the World Cup for a reason, because it really is the biggest international spectacle. And I'm glad the light was shown on things, but I'm also glad that people, for the most part, kept watching and saw these incredible games and saw the love and the passion for the world sport in a way that kind of was deserved on this biggest stage. And I hope they take away from that, because that was good in these ways. And the bad is stuff that we can work on and stuff that we can be inspired to make better.
Mm-hmm. Andrea Canales is soccer editor for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Andrea, great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Likewise, Scott. Thank you.
Coming up, Jane Clayson talks to Jill Schlesinger of Jill on Money about some lessons we can take from this year's economic news that could help you plan for 2023. That's after the break.
The end of 2022 is drawing closer, and many of us are saying, thank goodness that's over. But as the year ends, it's time to pull out some lessons from the financial world and hopefully apply them to a better year ahead. And who better to do that than Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So it's no surprise that 2022 was a tough financial year for a lot of people. And a key piece of all of the chaos was inflation. There was hope that costs would actually drop this year as supply chain bottlenecks eased and the pandemic subsided. But prices actually went up, Jill. Why?
Well, I mean, as you mentioned, there was the pandemic, and that really did stymie a lot of the supply side. But remember, we have another side of our economics 101 equation, and that is demand. And demand surged post-pandemic, and especially at the beginning of this year, as many people came out of their homes, really started to encounter the economy in a quote-unquote more normal way. So you have demand going way up, you have supply constrained, and that is the perfect combination for inflation. Inflation did peak in June, the headline CPI rate at 9.1% higher than a year ago. It has been coming down, but you know, through November, we still see CPI up 7.1% from a year ago. That's still awfully high. So it's not down to anywhere that is close to comfort yet.
So demand went up. Interest rates also went up, and they went up quickly. What does that foretell for next year, now that the cost of borrowing is higher?
You know, obviously, the Federal Reserve got a late start on its interest rate hike campaign. Just to go back, the beginning of the year, January and February, the federal funds benchmark lending rate was at 0%. And now we're at 4.25% to 4.5%. So as you rightly say, this is really the fastest pace of increases that we've seen in the modern history. What it means is the Fed is trying to slow down the economy, and it is starting to see the effects of that. But the real concern, of course, is that the Fed started too late, had to raise so quickly that, in fact, it will slow down the economy so much that we end up in a recession. And I think the chatter around recession was really big throughout the year. It's going to get louder when we turn the page into 2023, and we will slow down. We don't know whether it's a classic recession or not, but it will seem like a recession for anyone who's basically losing a job or cutting back, getting hours cut back.
Well, that's not good news. What about the housing market? What did we learn about it last year, and what does it mean for the year ahead?
You know, the Fed does not actually control the rates on which mortgages are based, but those general interest rate increases fed through to all parts of the market. And we did see the 30-year fixed rate mortgage pop up over 7% a couple of months ago. Now we're in the 6 to 7% range. And what that's really done is it means that all those first-time homebuyers who didn't quite get a chance to get in, they're contending with higher rates at a time where activity may be slowing in the housing market, but prices have not come down dramatically. In fact, if you look at where we are price-wise for the housing market, we're still above where we were pre-pandemic. So we have to see prices come down, or else those first-time buyers are going to continue to be shut out.
Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. What a year it was, Jill. Thanks so much for the perspective. We'll hope for better things ahead.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, Jill.
Up next, the UN Convention on Biodiversity ended Monday morning with what some are calling a historic deal to protect nature. So what does it do? Find out after the break. That's how much of the planet's land and water ecosystems world leaders have agreed to protect by the year 2030. It isn't much if you consider before humans came along, they had 100% to themselves. Or when you hear the United Nations estimate that humans are currently threatening 1 million species with extinction. But it's a much bigger promise than many expected. And more than previous UN conventions, like the one that just wrapped up in Montreal, have produced before. Benji Jones is an environmental reporter with Vox, and he told Scott it's fair to call the deal historic.
We've never had a land or water conservation target that big before, certainly not one that becomes an agreement that 196 countries around the world are all aiming for. So just that target alone is enormous, but there are a bunch of other ones related to corporate responsibility, restoration, subsidies, and it just goes on and on. And there are 23 of them. So it really is incredibly ambitious.
But here's the thing, Benji. I understand this agreement is not binding. And we know countries often fall short of their targets for these kinds of things. So where's the real motivation here for these 190 plus countries?
Along with this framework, this deal with targets, there's a monitoring framework as well, which is essentially they're going to be measuring progress and then countries will hold each other accountable. You'll have the civil society, nonprofits also doing assessments and holding these countries accountable as well. And then I think one other point to mention is just that the finance sector is more involved in biodiversity conservation than ever before. I think they're starting to get worried that investments might be at risk because of declines in nature. So if they're invested in a company that requires pollination from insects and insects are in decline, like that could affect the investors. Mm-hmm. And so just seeing this interest from the financial sector, which really like money is power, money moves people to do things. I think that is really helping motivate people to be like, okay, we actually need to abide by these targets.
Oh, I see. I mean, similar to climate change, right? These big Wall Street money managers are seeing that as financial risk in certain sectors.
Exactly. That's right.
Okay. You know, as these things go, so often the biggest question is who pays for all this? I mean, this will cost tens of billions of dollars at least, right?
Yeah, that's right. So there's this one number that's thrown around all the time. When you're in this meeting, and this is what produced this kind of historic agreement that we're talking about, you hear this number, $700 billion, come up a lot. And it is the gap in financing necessary to conserve nature. It comes from this report in 2020. This report is saying that countries need to come up with $700 billion to actually conserve nature into the future. That's an enormous number. This agreement did not get close to that, but there were big numbers in this deal for nature. And the headline figure is $200 billion a year by 2030. And then one of the most contentious topics in this conference and really in any environmental negotiation is how much money are developed countries, so the richer nations often in the West, going to pay developing countries to meet some of these targets because they have fewer resources, yet they're some of the most biodiverse rich countries in the world. So there was back and forth for a long time with how much money is going to go into this fund for developing countries, basically foreign aid. And that number is $20 billion by 2025 each year, and then $30 billion by 2030. And that's also annual. It's pretty significant. Again, it's not closing the gap necessary, but it's a lot of money.
Yeah, right. And as you say, these emerging economies, say Indonesia, Brazil, are where the biggest rainforests are. So this really matters as for where money is going to go to those countries. I want to ask you, Benji, to step back here a lot and just help the rest of us understand what's at stake here. In a Vox podcast, you interviewed author Michelle Nyehaus about her book, Beloved Beasts, Fighting for Life in an Age of Extinction. And here's a little bit of that conversation.
we can't save everything. There are going to be more extinctions. You know, some of the bad news will come to pass and is coming to pass, but that doesn't mean all is lost.
So Benji, give us an illustration from your reporting to bring this all home for us as far as how you see what's at stake here.
We all can imagine the cute animals, the pandas, the tigers, the animals we might interact with on walks. Mm-hmm. I think that maybe we don't think as much about just all of the ways that we are so dependent on nature and on wildlife. I was just talking to the head of the Worldwide Fund for Nature, also known as WWF, the largest environmental organization, and he was telling me about just the importance of respecting and thinking about some of the lesser known species like moths. Like, moths are major pollinators. We depend on them for literally sustenance, like to survive with food. So I think the point I'm trying to make is that there are so many ways in which we need healthy ecosystems for our own sake. So even if we don't have like a love, an inherent love for nature, you don't love the outdoors, hiking, whatever, your clothes come from plants, your food comes from plants, our water often comes from streams that are cleaned by vegetation in the riverbank. So there's just so many examples like that. And then we also know that just over the summer, there were massive heat waves, and some of the only relief you can get if you live in cities is these small chunks of grass and trees and so forth. So there's very clear benefits just for health as well. We also know that there are connections between deforestation and the spread of zoonotic diseases. So there are just so many linkages between the health of an ecosystem and the health of humans. And I think it's important to constantly be thinking about that connection beyond just like, oh, this is a cute animal, which of course is cool too.
Yeah. Benji Jones is senior environmental reporter at Vox. He's speaking to us from Montreal, where world representatives just reached a historic agreement on biodiversity. Benji, thanks for your work.
Thanks so much for having me.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now, from NPR and WBUR Boston. We're following the wrap-up of the January 6th committee in Congress, and we'll have up-to-the-minute news at hereandnow.org. You can also follow the latest at npr.org or on the NPR Politics podcast. Today's stories were produced by Thomas Danielian and Hafsa Qureshi. Our editors today are Gabe Bullard and Joe Ryan. Technical direction from Max Liebman and Mike Moschetto. Theme music by Max, Mike, and me. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. The executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.